This episode is brought to you by Privacy. So for those that don't know by now, Privacy lets you buy things online using virtual cards instead of having to use your real ones, protecting your identity and bank info while you're online. Right now, new customers will automatically get $5 to spend on their first purchase if you go to privacy.com/barcode to sign up. So I can't tell you how long I was searching for a quick and easy yet secure service to protect my financial information if I was making an online purchase. And my main concern was the same one that you have, securing that payment info and where that payment info goes after you hit confirm purchase. Well, with Privacy, you're in control. It puts you in the driver's seat. You know, you set the speed limit. You can put that cruise control on 55 or 105. It's your call. So before you make that next online purchase, hit up privacy.com/barcode and get yourself an account with $5 to spend on your first purchase. privacy.com/barcode.
You're listening to the Barcode Podcast with your host, Chris Glandon, serving cybersecurity straight up with no chaser. Let's hit the bar and grab a drink.
Yo, Boozbot. Good to see you, my dude. It's been a while.
Hello, Chris. Yes, I was on a leave of absence, enjoying some time off with my dog, Spike. I was working so much here, it felt like we were growing distant.
Oh man, I understand.
The continued lack of data I was receiving meant more hidden doubts and inadequate outcomes.
Yeah, I know what you mean, man. So what are you guys doing to bond together?
Well, I read to him using my integrated text-to-voice technology. I train his ML capability, as you train mine. He is becoming smarter by the page. The book we are reading is breathtaking.
Glad to hear it, man. So anyway, where's Tony at? Did he call out again?
Affirmative. He reported the excuse of car trouble, but my UBA function flagged it as suspicious, and I am overriding that excuse with hungover.
Yeah, definitely more realistic. So Boozbot, can you make a good drink for me, quick? Nothing with too much mechanics involved.
Yes. It's called Tiger Blood. It's simple, yet aggressive in nature. 3 ounces vodka, 1 ounce ginger ale, and 2 ounces of pomegranate juice. Pour it all into a glass with ice. Add 2 to 4 splashes of lime juice. Stir, and enjoy.
Sold. Thanks, man. I'm out. Two good friends of mine just walked through the door. I'm gonna go hit them up.
Copy that. I will see you next round.
I'm here with two cybersecurity sales leaders, Neil Saltman and Doug Gauthier. Neil is the author of the book, Cybersecurity Sales, A Buyer's and Seller's Perspective, which is an amazing resource, by the way, for those on either side of the line. And as long as I've personally known Neil, I know he is indeed a true connector of people finding solutions for security issues across the board and is always down to help anyone. He thrives off of healthy competition, leading sales initiatives, and overcoming every challenge he is faced with. Doug is also a veteran account executive with over 15 years experience helping enterprise clients with their cybersecurity needs. I've also have been fortunate enough to know Doug for many years as well, and have personally seen the value that he brings to organizations with the methodology of putting the client first. And for those heading out to HIMSS this year, check him out there. He's going to be presenting at this year's conference in Vegas on healthcare data breaches. Is that right?
Yeah, data breaches within healthcare, and really what's going on, what's important for healthcare, to look at, and more importantly, how does data analytics and SIMS play a part into it today?
Awesome. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for joining me at Barcode. It's an honor to have you finally get on the show. I know you're regulars here. But to actually get to talk to you guys is an honor and a privilege. So Neil's holding up his book, Cybersecurity Sales. I actually have mine.
And I'm holding up my book, of cybersecurity sales because I'm acknowledged in it.
Look at that. Look at that. Look at that. What page is that on? Oh, so we can have like everyone go and highlight it in their copies.
Page 3, I believe.
Towards the beginning.
Yeah, it's like right in the beginning. Yeah.
You should know it by heart, man. Page 3, line 4.
I should.
I have mine. It's packed. I'm taking the Black Hat with me. So I'm going to be walking around Black Hat with the book in my hand. So everybody I talk to, I'm just going to mention it too, because it's invaluable for those. And nothing really has been written, you know, in that format. So.
Yeah, it was an awesome experience. It's one of the better ones I've had in my career. So
yeah, I want to kick things off on that topic. You know, there's often a struggle between sales and leadership. And from an organizational standpoint, leaders and CISOs, they get hit from every angle, whether it's phone calls, whether it's emails, whether it's in person now. And from that perspective, you know, it's difficult from their side to see what the value is in a solution because there's so much noise. So Neil, I'll start with you. What has worked for you in terms of establishing an initial conversation with those leaders and getting your foot in the door and then just building upon that, regardless of the solution that you're presenting them with?
So I'll say first, before even getting into any mediums that work, I heard a story from a CISO that made me laugh. And he said, don't throw axes over a fence and hope that they land, or don't throw hammers over a fence and hope that they stick, right? And his point was that if all you're doing is coming out with as many messages as you can and hoping one of them resonates, I'm just going to take those hammers and throw them right in the moat, right? Where they're not going to do any good. So the first thing I was taught a long time ago is to be genuine, to be sincere, and to be yourself. So write, speak the way that you would talk to your friends. Don't go in with this robotic message of, you know, we use AI and machine learning to do this and that. Going with an authentic message of, hey, how can I help? And I think that that makes a big difference. I would say from the aspect of mediums, the world's changed a lot, right? Events used to be big. The more people know your face, the more they want to talk to you. So be at the same events, the leaders. Now, you know, it's virtual. We're starting to get back to in person, but we're not there yet. I think that the key is that whatever medium you choose to use, make sure that you know something about the person you're reaching out to. And that's not to say you can't reach out cold, but at least know something about the industry, maybe some sort of compliance effort that they're responsible for, or something that's going to mean something to them, and go in with, hey, here's a problem that I solve. I think this is going to be relevant to you. Let them say yes or no. And I'll even add to that, that another CISO said to me that I don't owe you a response. Like, it doesn't matter how many times or ways you reach out to me. If I don't know you, I don't owe you a response. You can reach out 100 times and you're saying, well, be respectful and, you know, tell me I'm not interested. Well, I love that idea. It's a great concept. But the reality is when you're getting dozens of those or more per day, they're not going to respond to everybody. And eventually, you either need to change your messaging, change the person you're reaching out to, or realize it's just not a good opportunity for you. So I think at a high level, that's probably the best way I can answer that question.
Yeah. And I echo what you say, Neil, because You're at a little bit more of an established organization today, where I have been operating in startups throughout my career, right? Aside from some of the larger organizations, and, you know, knee jerk reaction with many strategists in leadership is just bang the phones, right? Pump out as many messaging emails as possible, and hopefully one will stick, right? And that doesn't work in this day and age, right? In our, where we are today, especially with the pandemic, the new mediums, the old mediums, et cetera, on how to communicate, you have to be different, right? You have to be genuine. And, you know, just recently met a great group of folks and they said the same thing, right? It's, you got to know something about them, what's important to them, in order for them to want to return your call or respond to your email. And with that, you know, with my team, I say personalize it. Don't be salesy, right? In the sense of, I have the best in breed technology that doesn't resonate anymore, right? You and about 50 other guys and gals that are trying to sell their products are saying the same exact thing. And it's super important to really set yourself apart. And I hate to say this, but don't be a sales guy, right? Be different.
Well, and I'll compliment Doug in that, you know, I am a believer that the relationship sale is coming back around full circle, right? Where everybody said relationships are dead, they don't matter. Everybody's got the information they need to know, and, you know, on the internet. But the reality is that with, you know, thousands of vendors, there's still so much noise that you have to be in front of. One thing Doug does really well is if he doesn't have relationships with leaders in a certain area, because he covers big territory, he reaches out to people he knows that may not be leaders that know other people. And referrals are so big, right? It's not just for real estate anymore, right? It's, you know, referral selling is big, right? You reach out to your network and you say, hey, who do you know that has this problem? And as somebody put it to me before, it's, you know, if I went to you and said, who wants to buy a car? You'd be like, oh, I'm sure everybody does. But if I said to you, hey, who's hauling, you know, a boat and all these things and really needs a truck that's going to be able to help them get to this point, you're going to be like, oh, my buddy, you know, my buddy Bo has a boat, right? And that might be a good fit. But if you can help them be specific and say, here's a problem I solved. Do you know anyone with this problem? You're going to get a lot better feedback. And Doug does a pretty good job of reaching out to his network, whether it's security leaders or friends or people in the industry saying, who do you know that might have this problem? So I think that makes a big difference as well.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to what you said in terms of sort of knowing your prospect up front, knowing their industry to a degree, understanding compliance regulations. If it is healthcare, okay, they need to, you know, follow HIPAA requirements, and being able to approach your solution, but sort of custom fit it to that industry, right? How important is that up front? I guess it is important if you have a target prospect, but if you're on a conference room floor or a trade room floor and you have folks coming up to you that are sort of blind to what you do and you're blind to what they do, how do you start that conversation?
So, I mean, it depends, right? I mean, for me, it's not necessarily a cookie cutter approach. You know, I always go with the personal approach. I try to get to know the person and what their challenges are. I don't usually assume this is your problem unless I'm forced to assume. You know, you run into it is a world of introverts. I saw a shirt that said Introverts Unite. And I laughed because my first thought was the world I live in. And yeah. So when you're in front of an introvert, I think you have to start the conversation of, you know, we just completed project A with company B. And, you know, would that be relevant based on the fact you're in the same industry? And, you know, maybe it's around compliance. Maybe it's around cloud transformation. Maybe it's around some project. But I think tying it to a project makes a difference. But I really think that one-on-one relationship and that conversation makes a difference. I mean, Doug and I were at a dinner a while back, and one of the guys was talking about how he's a firefighter at night, right? He's a volunteer firefighter. He gets like 3 hours of sleep a night. I promise you, if you send him a follow-up note that says, you know, man, I hope you got sleep afterwards. It's really cool what you're doing on the side with firefighting. He's going to respond a lot quicker than, you know, I work with this other company that's just like you, and I really think I can solve problems. It's the personal aspect to it. And I think that matters. And then you get into the problems and people start to open up the Komodo and say, well, here's the challenges that we have. And you can say, well, hey, we can solve that, or we can't, but I know a great guy named Doug, and you know, that guy solves world hunger. So,
so a network of other sales folks, right, that you can maybe point to if your solution doesn't help solve their particular issues.
Yeah. Solve problems, and don't focus on necessarily as much, you know, it is what can I do for you, but the key is actually be a resource and not just a transactional, I can sell, I can help you, or no, go pound sand, right? Don't be the transaction guy, be a relationship guy.
And that's a big difference, right? So when you ask that question, you're on the conference floor and you don't know where he's coming from or what industry. I try to preach as much as I can, but be an expert in the areas that you're operating in, right? And that is, okay, if you're endpoint security, be an expert at endpoint security as a salesperson as much as you can, but also what else is that ecosystem involved in, right? What other security stacks connect to the endpoint solution? If you are well-versed in those areas and you can be conversational, they're going to want to talk to you, right? And more importantly, be personal and don't sell. Again, listen. Great listening skills will go a long way, right? And Neil talks about that in his book, right? Because, and he just said it here, if you just sit down, talk to the person and learn about them as well outside of the project, it goes a long way, right? And they're going to take your call. They're going to take your email or LinkedIn Connect, right? And that is really what separates the sellers, the volume sellers, to sellers like Neil, myself, and others where, you know, we're working with the largest organizations in the world that are giving us the keys to their project and we're giving them advisement, right? And our team is giving them advisement, and hopefully we're working on million-dollar deals. So knowing
your product to a great detail where you can speak on it, how about the importance of knowing your competitor's product? Absolutely. And knowing the differentiators there as well.
That goes hand in hand, right? So when I talk about just really knowing the where you're operating in, it's not just who you are, but who are your competitors, right? And more importantly, what are the pros and cons of each one of them, right? So that you can talk to them. That's a great solution. But what you're telling me, those areas that are important to you, those are the areas that they're lacking in, right? And here's why. And here's how we solve that area of focus for you, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that when you talk about your competition, it's such a big conversation, right? So first off, I think you don't want to mention them unless there's a reason to, right? There's no reason to give them mind share unless there's a reason, right? It's, the old saying that, if you go into Home Depot and they said, oh man, our price is so much better than Lowe's, like, oh, how far away is Lowe's? I want to go double check that, right? Or let me look online and see what the price looks like. And so all of a sudden you're like, well, hey, I just opened up the door of my competitor that may not have had. So first off, I would say know your strengths, but know if they bring something up, whether or not they're talking about your competitor. If they start mentioning features and functionality that you don't do and your competitor does, it means you're probably not winning right now. You're probably in a situation you're playing from behind. So you need to know those landmines that are set, and you need to be able to do the opposite in return and at least position yourself in a way that you're stronger. But yeah, you do need to know the competitor. I think a lot of people will open up the door and they'll tell you what they like and what they don't like. But more importantly, because you do want to understand the customer's challenges, but you really want to understand when you hear certain things being said that they may just be looking to lower the price on their existing solution instead of actually buying yours, right? Are they looking for a solution or are they looking for your solution? And that's what you want to understand is, are you in the driver's seat that they're trying to solve a problem that you solve? Or are they really just talking to your competitor and saying, well, I bet I can drive down the price if I bring these guys in?
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. Because if you're too focused on one competitor, that doesn't make you look too good either.
Yeah, exactly. You look desperate. You start to say, well, this guy really talks a lot about, Microsoft or AWS or whoever the monster in the room is. And he really seems to talk a lot about that. I didn't even bring that up. Maybe they really do what these guys do, right? And so you put yourself in a bad spot when you start to do that.
Yeah. And again, that right there, that you'll see a lot of rookies do that. They'll knee jerk start talking about that. When you know a lot about your competitors as somebody that's been in the market for a long time, just like Neil says, don't bring it up unless they start talking about them specifically, and don't bring up others, right? It has to be part of the conversation that they initiate, that you're providing context and information on and how you differ, right? But again, tit for tat is not very good. So it's you got to be mindful of that conversation and where it's going.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why this just came to me, but there was when I first got into sales, I was in real estate. And I remember the first training I took, and the guy asked me who my competitor was. And he asked it as a teeing up a question because he had a response ready for it. And I said, just to make it up, let's say I worked for Coldwell Banker. And I said, oh, Remax is my competitor. And he looked at me and he said, are they still in business? And I was like, is this guy nuts? Like, what's he talking about? And his point was that, like, your competition doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter who it is. You jokingly say, are they still in business? Because the point is, can you solve the problem or can't you, right? It doesn't matter. You're competing against do nothing or do something with somebody else. But your competition should be the second part of that equation, not the primary focus.
Got it. Doug, you did mention, the rookie aspects. And I'm curious, when you guys came in and you started your sales career, what rookie mistakes did you guys make that you could help advise others not to?
So I started my career as a stockbroker trainee on Wall Street. Totally different selling style. We're yelling on the phone. We're trying to capture people's attention that pick it up quickly. And then I transitioned into software sales. That goes from, from the stock market going 100 miles an hour to you got to tone that bad boy down in terms of your pitch, your energy, to about a 20, right? And that was a big thing for me. Another, some rookie mistakes that I made, right, was you got to keep your cool, right? As a rookie, or in our world, BDRs, SDRs, college kids coming into the sales world, they need to make 50, 60, sometimes $100 a day. When they get on the phone, they're not ready. They're not prepared, right? To go through what can that person on the other end of the line say to them, right? And what does a rejection sound like? And how do you respond to it? What's that rebuttal? And I don't think there's enough practice. Now that there's a blend of blame to that. One is that person not studying enough on the rebuttals, on their product, on sales methodology that's being taught to them, as well as leadership accountability and mentoring and observing how their team is operating. Those are two different areas, right? And for me, when I first started in software sales, I did just that, right? I wasn't ready because all I was thinking about was I need to make my dials because my manager was going to be all over me and say, why didn't you make all these calls, right? It was all about volume and just trying to get somebody on the line. And with that, you lose focus. So it's important for mentors, leaders, or managers, however you want to view that person, to really kind of empower that rookie to know and be prepared for, as I call it, battle each and every day. And every time, if it's that 49th call that somebody finally picks up, you're ready. You're ready to rock and roll. You're not in space. You're not thinking about when the hell I'm going to get out of here, things like that. You're ready, right? That's what they call audible ready. And I think there are a lot of, and I'm seeing it today, there are a lot of people in this industry that are not audible ready. And that goes up to leadership as well and how people are trained and mentored today. So that was a mistake that I made because I was at fault for that because I didn't, you know, I didn't take it seriously. I was immature. I think we all were. But over time, when you start to see the success of being prepared, being audible ready, and starting to turn into that trusted advisor, that's when the money started coming in, right? That's when the deals started closing and we started seeing some big wins, right?
And that takes time, right? There's really no substitute for learning that.
It does. I mean, unless you're a born natural and, you know, your parents have been teaching you since you've been growing up, it's going to take time, right? And you're going to go through those peaks and valleys and it's hard. Sales is hard. And you got to have that will to just keep pushing forward and knowing the end goal. There's an important mindset for that too. We could talk about that after of, you know, guys like Neil and I, what really drives us to keep going, to really being the best that we can be. And it's how you set up your mindset. You got to want something. You can't do this just to pay the bills. You got to pay the bills, but also want something in the future, whether it's a boat, whether it's a multifamily building, whatever it may be. You got to set these milestones for yourself and set them high. You got to set them high because if you set them too low and you meet them, what's next? Right.
So yeah, you almost have to set them unrealistically, right? Because correct. You're never going to exceed past that threshold if you don't.
And Chris, let me tell you, I wasn't destined to be here. And Neil knows this, right? I had a tough upbringing, you know, a lot of challenges. I was poor and I needed to figure out how the hell am I going to get out of the situation? Right. There were times I couldn't pay for train fare in New York City. Right. And I had to figure things out. And that's how I stumbled into sales because that was the quickest way for me to earn a buck. Right. And the type of money that I wanted to make because I wanted more. I wanted more than what my friends had. And I got it. Right. And I got it because I had that drive to want it. And you can figure it out if you just try. And I think a lot of kids today, you know, with TV and everything else, they're not put in those situations anymore. Or, you know, for that matter, things are given to them.
But that mindset's now ingrained in your thinking, right? Like you've made it to a point where you don't need to worry about bus fare anymore, but it's still, the hunger is still there. And that's what
absolutely. Keeps that you. Hunger will never die.
He still loves the bus. Come on.
Yeah. I love the bus. I don't love the bus. My bus has a lot of horsepower in it.
That's
today.
Right. Now he owns the bus. That's the difference. Yeah. No, so I'll add to that, right? So rookie mistakes, I have plenty of my own, but there's one interesting that came up recently. So working for a platform vendor, we have a lot of partners. And so essentially there was a recent situation where a customer said to me, I just don't feel like they really care about working with me. Like there were a couple stumbling blocks. These guys made a couple mistakes, young rep. And when all was said and done, the customer said, hey, we're just not going to buy from them. So I try to do the mature thing. You know, we have to age. We don't always have to mature, but I did do the mature thing. And I tried to share with him and say, you know, hey, here's what happened. And here's what the customer said. And he seemed to take it decently on the phone, and we had a good conversation. And I was like, all right, good. I appreciate that. Anyone who wants to learn, I love helping people. If I can help someone get better, awesome. If I can help them even turn the situation around, I'm happy to do it. We hung up the phone, and I got an email from him later on that day with a checklist of things I had done wrong. And I kind of chuckled when I read it, and it was like, hey, here's what you told me. Here's what the customer said. Here's the situation. And I read it, and I sat for like 5 minutes at my keyboard thinking, how do I write back to this? And then I wrote back, the underlying message is that the customer felt like you didn't want their business. I said, if you want to talk through this, I'm happy to help in any way that I can, but taking a defensive approach doesn't help anybody. And that's what happened, is lost the deal and immediately came to me and said, here's why it's everyone's fault. And that doesn't do any good. And I think that's a young mentality is, you know, I lost a deal early on. I had this multi-million dollar deal when I had a really small quota that would have retired 3 to 4 years worth of quota for me. And they told me they loved my product because they used it at past companies. So I told everybody they were going to buy. And again, it goes back to, do they need a product or they need your product? Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, I'm like, hey, this is, you know, millions of dollars. I'm like, all right. And they didn't say anything to me. And then they went and bought my competitor for like a fourth of the price. And then I found out after the PO came in, and I was like, oh my God. And luckily I never committed it. I just kept, you know, talking about it like, hey, look at what a big deal I am. But you know, it's when you miss the details, you got to learn from those things. And when you start, I could have pointed the finger and said, well, the customer lied to me, but he didn't. He loved my product in the past. He just didn't want to pay for it. So it's, you got to learn from your own mistakes. And I think that's a young mistake we all make. I mean, when I was an inside sales rep, I was pounding the phones like Doug says and getting a ton of meetings, and I was all excited and none of my reps were. I was like, why aren't you guys as excited as I am about these meetings? And they're like, because they're a waste of time. Yeah. What do you mean a waste of time? Like, they got on the phone with us. They're like, but they're not buying anything. So I wasn't qualifying. I was just qualifying the fact that they were the right person, not that it was the right fit. So there's a lot of things you have to learn early.
Yeah.
You have to actually take with you, as opposed to just rinsing, repeating, and doing the same thing.
And that again, that goes back to time, right? Time in the seat, experience, and more importantly, the right guidance. You got to be able to have somebody that is going to mentor you in the company, that is going to watch and see what you're doing and critique your, in this case, prospecting, qualifying, right? Is this actually a lead for the sales team? So on and so forth, right? And I don't see that quite often. I want to say so, but I don't.
From the mentor from side, certain,
right,
or from
on the leadership side, and specifically in the new BDR type of teams, right, where they're fresh, they need a set of eyes that's going to that person has to have a lot of experience in that area of focus. And there are times where you'll see young guys that get the role of managing BDR teams. I was one of them, and sometimes that works, and sometimes it's the wrong play, right? And you see a decline in the leads that go over to the team, and everybody hates each other at that point.
Well, and not to shift the conversation, but I saw an interesting post on LinkedIn the other day, and it was from a CISO that said, I wish salespeople would get the hint, right? Is, you know, is cold calling dead? Isn't it dead? Because I can tell you that every time I get a call, if I answer it, I end up angrier than before if I didn't, and I have to take certain calls. And so it was an interesting comment, and I think the key to that is that, you know, most people take no as they just need more education. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's wrong, because there is something to be said, is people like to say no instantly, and you do need to provide a little more information. But if somebody has told you no and you just keep pounding them over and over again, it's not going to go well for you, right? Unless there's something that's changed of, you know, that you're aware of. And I think that's an interesting point too, is what do young reps learn from? You're getting pounded by management all the time. You know, it's like the ambulance chasers and, you know, the lawyers, right? It's somebody goes to the hospital and every lawyer is like, oh man, there's a potential customer. And I don't know, maybe the guy's father is his lawyer, right? It's, you know, whatever it is. And maybe he doesn't want to sue anyone. Maybe it was his own fault. But immediately the assumption is that I can solve their problem without having any details. And that's how we all go in. And then when somebody stops you and says, I don't want to talk to you, your response is, well, wait a minute, let me tell you what I do. And I think there's a lot of that out there as well. Is that's why I say, be authentic, be you. It's like, hey, I'm really sorry you got breached. I know things are busy. What if you could use my product for 3 months? And even that's becoming a little too mainstream. But point is, come up with an approach that's not me too, and I could have solved that for you. Come at it from the customer's perspective and think about what they're going through.
Yeah, so it's not always what you say. It's more about how you say it and how you phrase it and how you come across.
Yeah, what you mean by it, right? I mean, there's a big difference in saying, you know, let me show you my product and, you know, hey, here's what we're doing for somebody else that I think would be interesting to you. I just said the same thing in two different ways. One of them actually has some thought behind it.
Yeah. So you get the attention of the CISO now, right? They're listening, right? They're interested in what you got to say. They're, you know, they see the value. When you talk about extending levels beyond the CISO and trying to prove value to the board or for budgeting, you know, it may be a little bit outside of your realm and maybe it's not, but I'm curious, you know, how do you help or enable a CISO to prove that ROI and present it to their board in a way that resonates?
So there's a lot of pieces to that, right? So first is that what's happening right now in large enterprise and even in some mid, not as much as small, is the delegation of dollars. So it doesn't always come to the CISO. It doesn't always come to the board. The question is, how big is the deal? What's the sign off approval? And then does it need to go beyond that? And if they're taking things to the board, it's good for them to have meaningful statistics or things that they can use that say, you know, then it becomes a business rationalization. Then it becomes, hey, we have 5 open headcount. And as long as those are open, we're saving this many dollars per month, which is a problem for us because we don't have the headcount and we have this. So all of a sudden you're taking things that mean something to them. Like, let's take those dollars and say, if we reduce one of those positions, we're saving X number of dollars per year and we're adding this much efficiency, right? And that's probably an extreme example, but point being, if you can take things that the board's going to care about that are business related and help them tie it, because a lot of CISOs are going to know that information. They're going to know that we have X number of dollars budgeted for positions. We have Y number budgeted for these projects. How can I move money around? And that's what the board and the people above them are going to care more about is, what does this mean to the business, right? How much more secure is my business? Where am I saving money? Why is this good for the business? It's less about, you know, how, unless it's program related, there's a lot of CISOs that have written out programs that said, here's what I'm going to do. And then you want to help them write up, how much is this moving the needle in the program you've got in mind? But you can't answer any of those without asking the security leader what it is they're presenting to the board and the business and where they're trying to get to. And then you can help them draw those comparisons and build charts and graphs and work with their team to do whatever needs to be done. But it still is going to take knowing what they're trying to accomplish to help them put that together.
Yeah. So just as you need to approach the CISOs, they sort of have that same mentality when they approach the board, right? They need to be able to communicate with them the way that they're known to digest that information, right? It's all strategy from their part as well.
Yeah. I mean, they're in business meetings most of the day, right? It's some are cyber related, some are where's the business going. And as one CISO put it to me, right? It's when I'm meeting with a business, I understand the business initiatives. When my engineers or my directors are meeting with you, they know what's going to make their life easier day to day, but it may not align with the business strategy. So there is a point where something is high enough dollar, high enough demand that you do have to go to the higher level to do those things. But again, it depends who you're meeting with, what you're talking about, and then you can help them build it out. And if you can build documentation for them and send it a PowerPoint that they can take what they need and send it up the chain, you're going to make their life easier.
You got to share relevant information for the area of your focus that you're going to help them. And it has to be information that is consumable to the board of directors, which is a whole different presentation than if you were presenting to your team.
Right. I want to talk about, you know, sales and SE relationships, because engineering has a huge play in the overall outcome of whether a sale is going to go through. And I'm just curious to get your perspectives on how close that relationship should be going in. And then, you know, walk me through the process of how the engineering aspect could either help or hurt the overall customer experience and closing the deal.
I do contribute a lot of my success, my high close rate, you know, per se in you know, opportunities, because of the relationship of myself and my SE, right? And it's really important that you both are lockstep. This is our business, right? We need to work together to try to, you know, get our product in front of as many organizations as possible. But when we get there, I need to trust you that once I hand this off to you, that you are really going to, you know, have everybody's, you understand what's entailed in the project, and you're not just presenting a technology, right? You want to ask questions that I may not have spotted, you know, in areas that we may be missing opportunity for, other areas that we provide services for, or we may be able to recommend other solutions. Like if it's Neil, for instance, and they're looking for a threat intelligence portal, and I didn't catch that beforehand in my discovery, we need to work together in that nature, right? You know, case in point, on the threat intelligence side, I had a phenomenal engineer that I worked with at my last company, and I couldn't have asked for a better relationship, right? And you know, with that, we were able to do some great business, you know, at that organization. Same thing with the other, with my endpoint engineer. What a great guy, right? And he can present like a seller. And that is really key for SEs, is that we, and Neil, you can either back me up or you know, say, well, but there are two types of SEs, I find. There are the SEs that are, they do have sales and business in their blood as well, but they're also very technically proficient and they're able to, you know, act as both. And then there are the SEs that are really technical, awesome guys, but you know, they don't have that business blood in them, right? That DNA. And they miss things that I'm not, you know, if I'm not on that call, you know, that it could be detrimental to the work, to the deal, right? And it's important that if you are aligned with somebody that is really good technically, but doesn't have that business savvy, that you can either work with them on training them if they're receptive to it, or you have to be a little more involved, right, in the technical portion of those meetings.
No, I laugh. You're right. There's the super technical, and then there's those that are business related. And I usually break it down to what I leave them at lunch table without me, the group, and worry about what happened when I leave, right? Are they going to sit there and focus on their food and not say a word, or say something completely, you know, it's going to break the deal, or are they somebody that I'm comfortable leaving behind? And so I agree with that. I think from a sales perspective, the best thing we can do is ask the right questions and hone in on the criteria and assume our engineer can do a good job of showing it. The engineer perspective, I think the key is being able to, you know, lethal simplicity, right? So be able to show them what they asked and not show them how great everything else is that you do, because a lot of platforms and a lot of technologies can do a million things. And if you start showing up and showing everything you can do, you're going to lose them on number three before you get to their point. And so, you know, one of the best SEs I've ever worked with, I would sit there and have a conversation. There you go. Yeah, there you go. Chris is definitely up there too. I love Chris. So, but yeah, I would be talking, and next thing I know, everything I'm saying is showing up in front of me, and I'm laughing because if I'm on the keyboard, I couldn't do 90% of what he did. But as I'm saying it, I'm watching it happen right in front of my face. And, you know, I think when the SE supports you like that, it's pretty seamless. So I think it's an incredibly important relationship, because you're relying on each other to do things. And if you can't count on them, I think you're in serious trouble, because one is that if you've ever seen a comedian perform, or anybody that's of professional stature perform, there's somebody that introduces them and it gives them credibility right off the bat, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're going in and you're both the performer and the guy that's doing the introduction, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so we introduce our SEs as the expert in the room. And then if you don't trust your SE, you've just introduced an expert that's not an expert, right? And so I think there's got to be a good relationship there, and you have to be able to trust each other.
Yeah. And with that too, you know, just speaking very highly of these SEs that we're using examples of, Chris Davis and Eric Payne, they know who they are. We worked really well together, and I wish I can take them to every single company that I go to. And that is, if there's one thing that is super important to be successful in business, is having the right team operating with you. You can't do this alone. This isn't an island. You got to work well with the people that you are surrounded with that are going to help empower you to be successful. Those are the SEs, working well with marketing. I'm going to digress here, but you know, working with really the core team that's going to get you to where you need to be and for the customer as well.
Agreed. And I think that you can learn from each other as well to become better in what you do. So as an SE, being able to talk to my sales rep, making sure that they understand the technical terminology that may come up at least at a high level versus saying, I don't know anything about that, you know? So I think everyone can work in that ecosystem together and learn from each other.
That brings up a memory of mine that I laugh about. So I got sent to a conference as the expert. I worked for a large company at the time, and I was a product focused rep. And they brought me out to this conference to be the expert. And it was like VP of everything in the company, VP of, you know, delivery, VP of sales engineering, VP of sales, VP of this. And they brought a couple product experts out there. And so I was at the table, and the CIO of a large state was at the table, and he was asking what we do. And so I answered the question, ended up being more technical than I expected. And he kept asking questions and questions and questions. And I finally said, look, I'm just the sales guy. I said, I only have so much information, so I apologize. And I didn't think anything of it because we all say that all the time, right? When that conversation ended, the VP of sales engineering walked over to me and she was red. And she said, don't you ever say that. And I was like, what did I do? Right? I didn't even know at the time what she was talking about. And she goes, don't ever say I'm just the sales guy. She said, because we brought you in as an expert. When you meet with a customer, you are the expert. Whether or not you are, you should know more about your product than they do, even if they're technical. And it's a good point, is that whether you're the SE or the rep, you are presenting yourself as the expert on the solution. And when you do that, because we all like to make jokes about ourselves and all that good stuff, right? You know, I've got a face for radio or whatever it is, right? We all make those jokes. And it's, and so it's not a big deal until you start to devalue what you're bringing to the table. And if you say, I'm just the sales guy, all of a sudden, everything you say from that point forward, like, well, he doesn't understand a solution.
Yeah.
And so you got to be careful of the words. Right. Yep.
Absolutely. Agree 100% on that one.
Yeah. And it gets the conversation going. It builds your confidence as well. And, you know, understandably, the person on the other end of that conversation, they should recognize that they may not get a deep dive on the tech at that moment. And there may be a drop off. And at some point, you'll need to continue that conversation later.
Yeah. And don't devalue yourself when you just say, okay, I got to get back to you with that. Right. That's a lot different than I'm just the sales guy. I don't know. Right. I don't know immediately is like, all right, right. The next person. Like, give me the manager. It's like the restaurant. Like, give me the manager.
If you start getting deep into the weeds, there are very, very smooth ways of transitioning into, well, I would love to, you know, get an engineer or, you know, whatever that may be in front of you. Are you available later today or for a second, you know, meeting or so on and so forth, right? Instead of saying, I'm just a sales guy, as Neil mentioned, or I don't know, or, you know, this is not an area that I'm an expert in, but the person that is currently unavailable, however you want to shape it, right? In the situation, in context.
Well, for me, that would just show trust, right? Like I trust you that you're being honest with me, you know, then putting on this facade that, you know, is going to already burn an image into my mindset that you're just trying to fake it. And you represent your product doing that.
Yep. Yeah. Unfortunately, you see that often when you're in conference floors. You know, they send the new folks in and they're answering these deep questions, and it discredits the brand too. So
it's when you bring out the pair of socks and say, "But you want to see these?"
Exactly.
Yeah.
It'll keep you warm.
Now, what about the eye candy that they bring in? You know what I'm talking about.
Remember, I think it was like 3 years ago, the controversy around they wanted to ban the booth girls, the booth babes.
I don't remember that.
Did they?
They actually did it. They started to make rules about what you can do for marketing because it was becoming such a problem. It was.
Yeah, because and then plus with society changing and, you know, what's the word for it?
Sexist.
Sexist. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. We brought them in when I was we brought some in, and they weren't like models, but they were attractive, smart women, but they knew nothing about what we sold. And they were bringing people left and right. And it was such a horrible situation being a rep because it was like, they would walk over and be like, oh, Neil, why don't you talk to Chris? I'm like, oh, Chris, what do you do? They're like, oh, I'm on identity and access management. I'm like, cool. What do you know about endpoint? Like, nothing. Like, are those some nice socks? Can I have those? All right.
Hey, swag goes a long way at conferences.
It does. It provides a draw, that's for sure.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
I got my barcode stickers. I'll be out at Black Hat with. People love stickers, so.
People love stickers. They
barcodes.
Yes, they do. There you go.
So both of you reside in two different areas. Neil, you're down in the DMV area, right? And Doug, you're up in New England. First, Neil, let me ask you, best bar in your area. If I'm in a DC metro area, where are you going to direct me to for good atmosphere and good drinks?
Best bar. So I'll be honest with you. I don't know if it's still open anymore, but I met my wife at Mackey's in DC, which was an awesome bar. And they used to have a lot of game watching parties, and where I went to college had a great atmosphere. But the whole DuPont area has a ton of them. But Mackey's was one of my favorites a while back. So now that I got young kids, it's I get to watch it on TV more than I get to actually join them. But that's where I send you.
Doug, how about you, man? But don't send me to a Patriots bar.
No.
You know, I'm an Eagles fan.
No, you should know by now. I'm not a big sports nut, you know? So it's I mean, I love sports, but football is not my you know, my main one. And Neil knows this. I'm a big wino. I love wine. I love good wine. And, you know, my wife, she found this really cool wine bar. And I was like, wine bar? I didn't know Boston had wine bars. It's always pubs, Irish pubs, et cetera, right? And big restaurants. We go to this place called Haley and Henry. And it was probably about no more than 10 seats in this place. But man, this was the coolest wine bar I've ever been to. They had hip hop, like Action Bronson playing loud, and they had really awesome natural wines. I don't know if you know anything about natural wines, but they're pretty good. And you can drink a lot more than usual on those. But yeah, great place. It's in downtown Crossing area.
Okay.
So if you're ever in Boston, you like wine, check it out. Really cool place. Really great vibes. They even have... You might want to close your ears, Neil, because I know you don't like seafood, but they have also imported tins of, you know, things like sardines and scallops and things like that. And they'll pair it with, different crackers and all that other stuff. It's good.
Nice.
Lost good. Credibility when you didn't say they have manischewitz there. Just saying.
I've had that. It's too sweet.
That's right. Pair that with some St. Ides.
There you go.
Oh.
Mad Dog 2020.
Yeah.
Oh, Steel Reserve.
Oh, man. When I was, I don't know if I should say this, but when I was a young one, skateboarding in New York City, just roaming the streets, that was our beer of choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which one? Steel Reserve?
Steel Reserve. It was cheap, but it was heavy hitting. It had a lot more alcohol content than the others. So,
Yeah. All right. Well, what are your go-to drinks? I know you like wine, right? What's your go-to, Neil? Like when you go to the bar, what do you order?
I'm a disappointment for you. I usually drink light beer or like rum and coke. I mean, that's
okay.
I stick to the basics. I went to a bar in New York City with a GM of a business unit I was working for, and he loved expensive drinks. And so he was really upset because he, you know, it was open bar tab. There was like 15 of us there, and he really wanted me to try some new things. So he got me, what was it? Macallan's 18. Isn't this the most amazing thing you've ever had? I'm like, yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
So, very new way.
So he was waiting for like some response, like, you know, like when you ask your wife to marry you, and she's like, yes, I will. He was waiting for that. And all he got was, yeah,
good. Good.
It's okay.
Do you like tequila?
I do. I've been trying to get my handle on that Tesla tequila.
Oh, yeah? It's
sold Tesla out. Tequila, yeah. Really? Have you seen that yet?
No, I didn't even know there was a Tesla tequila.
Oh, dude, they have a Tesla tequila and the bottle is in the shape of a lightning bolt. And I think it's $250, which isn't terrible. And I'd probably get it if they ever had it. So my next move is to set up a bot where I could just crawls the site. And next time it's available, it just buys it for me. Cause I swear every time I've gone on there, it's sold out.
That's funny.
And
The Rock has his own tequila. I heard is really good as well. But if you're going to spend $250 on a bottle of tequila, you got to go for Casa Azul.
Oh yeah.
You know, you got to go for something like that. for a mid-tier, you know, mid-priced, but really good, very flavorful tequila. Herradura is a very good one as well. You can't go wrong with the Reposado. I never had the Añejo. And yeah, but they're really good.
Have you had Trace? T-R-E-S?
No.
That's a pretty good one.
No.
Better than Dose?
Just kidding. Oh, better than Dose. Yeah, it's I would say it's one level above Dose.
Got it.
I like that. Level up.
A level up. All right. Well, I'm hearing last call here, fellas. You got time for one more?
Sure. Yeah.
If you opened a cybersecurity themed bar, what would the name be and what would your signature drink be called?
Cybersecurity themed bar. What would I say? That's a good question. After a collaboration theme, because I know CISOs like to collaborate. So we'll call it the collaboration bar. And, mixed drinks, I'd want to keep it simple. I'd probably just do something like a screwdriver. I'd probably do something very easy that everybody can order and everybody will drink.
I like it. All right, Doug, what about you?
It would be something related to Intel, right? Cyber Intel, because I love it. I love that area of focus.
So like the Intel bar?
Like the Intel bar, you know, something on a play of NSA or, you know, an APT group, you know, just something kind of funny that you could play on.
Yeah.
Call it the Trusted Circle.
Trusted Circle. There you go. Look at that. I'm writing it down. And then for a drink, it would probably be something Bond-esque, because even though cyber intelligence is, you know, we're sifting through forums and the dark web, et cetera, I still think of James Bond a little bit. So it's got to be a martini. Right?
There you go.
Yeah.
Shaken, not stirred. Right?
That's right. How it is? Yeah. You have to put that on that menu. There's no other way that it's served there.
That's right.
That's awesome. Thanks again, guys, for joining me. You know, I truly appreciate the insight that you shared, and I look forward to catching up with you guys at the next one. Take care. Be safe.
Thank you.
Peace.
Barcode patrons, if you like this episode and would like to support the podcast, rate us on Apple Podcasts and visit our Patreon site, patreon.com/barcodepodcast. If you're interested in sponsoring the show, check out the barcodepodcast.com/sponsor. Cheers.
Unfortunately, it's time to shut the bar down for this episode. Thanks for stopping in. See you next time. We'll save you a seat. Be sure to check us out at thebarcodepodcast.com.
This episode is sponsored by Nucleus Security. Nucleus is a security management and workflow tool that aggregates and correlates data from anywhere, making it actionable for the teams that need it, when they need it, fast. Know your risk with global, project, and asset level views that provide visibility across all teams and data streams. Make better decisions faster with dashboards, drill downs, and reports that are robust, shareable, and flexible. And save hours and dollars with workflows for automating repetitive, time-consuming tasks. You should check these guys out at nucleussec.com. That's NucleusSec.com.